We live in this world more or less contented for a long time, thinking that, well, we'll get what we're looking for someday. Someday we'll be able to have all the things that we've been trying to buy, all the money that we've been trying to accumulate, all the experiences and satisfactions that we think that this world will be able to provide to us. And somehow always it falls short. And always there is something in the nature of this world, in the nature of the things, that cheats us of that real desire, that real fulfillment. And so it is that we come to the point where finally we understand that if we are to achieve what we're looking for, we need a drastic change in our approach to life. I went through this many years ago. I went through it thinking for a long time that I was going to find it not in things, because I gave up on those fairly early, but I thought I'd find it in ideas. I thought I'd find it in places. I thought I'd find it in people. I used to travel a great deal, and I would come into a new town, and I think within a week I would know half the people in that town. I made it a big thing to get out there and meet people and try to understand what made them tick, and I felt that somewhere and in some way of looking at things, I felt somebody would give me the answer. And yet I found always, wherever I went, it was the same ignorance. People were all sort of rehashing the same theme, playing the same broken record in different languages. The broken record being that I and mine, that song of thinking that I will get what I want when I have my own desires fulfilled. The last thing that I expected I would ever do would be to accept a role of discipleship, accept a role of somebody to try to offer to help me to find what I was looking for, because he knew more than I did. I assumed that I thought I'd find it by meeting people, but I thought that I would draw it from them and I would create more and more this philosophy, this understanding that would give me joy, that would give me wisdom, that would give me an expanded awareness. And I found that as long as I was thinking in terms of I doing it, in terms of I getting out there and grasping it from life, I thought I'd get it, and I found that it was always receding, like that famous parable of the carrot on the stick, and the dog straining after that and never reaching it. And so I remember finally reading that great book, Autobiography of a Yogi, which I imagine most of you have read. And taking the next bus across the United States and meeting the author, Paramahansa Yogananda, in Los Angeles. And the first words I said to him were, "I want to be your disciple." I had reached the point where I knew that I wasn't going to be able to find what I was looking for just by my own efforts. I had to open myself. I couldn't just go around traveling, grasping, thinking I could get it by snatching at life. I came to the point where I realized that I was making rather a mess of it on my own. I wasn't getting what I was looking for so long as I was trying to just create it out of my own thoughts. And then I became a disciple of this great master. And I came to appreciate what a tremendous blessing this was. To be able to live with somebody who knew my innermost thoughts, to be able to live with somebody who knew what my real needs were, not always, in fact, very often not at all, the needs that I thought. In fact, I remember one time getting quite upset with him because I felt that he didn't understand, that he was giving me things that would be harmful to my own spiritual growth. And yet I discovered, by the fact that I had faith in him and therefore followed him anyway, I discovered that yes, he was right and I was wrong. I found that by this role of discipleship, I was able to gradually clear away many of the weeds and make it possible for me to grow a few decent crops in this field of consciousness. And so it was that I came to see what a tremendous good fortune it was to be able to open myself to new vistas of understanding that I wasn't creating out of my own mind. And thus, I reached the point where it really amazed me to find how many people in this world were in a state of consciousness, which in fact I had myself. But how much resistance there is in this country today to the ideal of discipleship. The thought of learning anything from anybody is anathema to the average American. And we find that the common press, the popular press today, is down on all these teachings because they say you don't want anybody to tell you what to do, as if anybody was there forcing you to do anything. But our country is in the delusion that I was in too. Our country is in that thought that I myself shared. That thought that we don't need to go to anybody to tell us what to do. That thought that we don't want to follow anybody because to follow other people means that we are going to be like automatons, like slaves, like people under Jim Jones. And of course everybody hangs up that story as a warning not to follow others. And yet never do the spiritual teachings say to turn your conscience over to somebody else. Never do the spiritual teachings tell you that you mustn't do that you must do something that goes contrary to your own real inner feeling. My inner feeling was that I had met a man who knew more than I did, and he never asked me to do anything against my conscience. What he did was gradually show me how I could develop and sort of fine-tune that conscience. And indeed, living with him, I began to understand things about myself that I hadn't ever understood before. And yet, it's been amazing to me to see how on the spiritual path many people have warned me, warned others on the path that we're doing all the wrong thing, because what we really should do is follow the way of the world. And I look around me and I see, what is the way of the world giving people? Is it giving them happiness? Is it giving them the things they want? Because I certainly don't believe that we should be giving something that they don't want. But what do people want, and are they getting it? We want freedom. We pride ourselves on freedom. We pride ourselves on being a free country. Are we really free so long as we are bound by desires that take us into all the states of consciousness that we would have to equate with real bondage? Because I know some people can be in prison and yet be free in their hearts. But when a person can live even in a palace, even in a wonderful suburban home with 4 bedrooms and 3 cars and have a job that gives him all sorts of money and a portfolio that gives him a great deal more, and he can go to other countries when he wants to, and he can do anything that he wants to, and yet he isn't happy. Is that freedom? I remember going from Mexico to Taxco in Mexico City to Taxco in 1945 with a couple of millionaires who were the heads of a company that a friend of mine was being employed by to set up a new branch of that company. And these men drove at about 90 miles an hour down those winding roads, couldn't get to Taxco fast enough, passing beautiful countryside but not looking at anything. They had to get to Taxco. And we got to Taxco. And after 15 minutes, they had to get back to Mexico City. They hadn't found what they wanted in Taxco. Maybe it was back there. They'd just come from there and they hadn't found it there either. This thought that you've got to rush here and there, you've got to dash from one place to another, you've got to... I remember being in an art exhibit in New York many years ago, and I was enjoying a painting. I forget what painting it was, but it was beautiful, and I was just sort of sitting there drawing it in, drinking it in, and I heard this strident voice of a guide in the room that I had just left, talking about, and this is a painting by that great French painter Monet, and if you will watch the brush strokes there, you will see how he uses them very differently from, and she went on like this. And it didn't quite fit the mood of the painting, but anyway. I was watching the painting after they had hastened through this room into my room, And I was still watching the same painting when they were about two rooms ahead of me. It was like that story I heard about, read about the two American tourist ladies going through the Louvre in Paris. They probably called it the Louvre. And one of them said, well, you could look at the paintings and I'll study the Baedeker and that way we'll get through faster. This thought of gobbling your experiences and thinking that you're gaining more because you're taking so much more in. This is, unfortunately, a sort of a typically American delusion. We think that if it's more and better, that it'll be better. If it's more and bigger, I mean, it'll be better. It's like the story of the students from different countries who were asked to write an essay on the elephant. And the Frenchman wrote about lovemaking among the elephants, and the German wrote about the uses of the elephant in time of war, and the Englishman wrote about the aristocratic character of the elephant, and perhaps the Italian wrote about love calls of the elephants, and the Indian wrote about the philosophical nature of the elephant, and the American wrote about how to make bigger and better elephants. This attitude of bigger and more. This is what we have in this country, and it's somehow it doesn't seem to get us what we're looking for. We have our big cars, we have our big homes, we have our big expense accounts, we have our big portfolios, we have our big opportunity to do all sorts of things, and yet somehow there is this anguish in the hearts of so many Americans, where you see that they are well dressed, you see that they are well fed, you see that their bodies are well cared for, and yet their eyes don't show happiness. Their eyes don't show that contentment of one who has found what he's really looking for. And I have seen that sometimes in peasants. I've seen that sometimes going out into the villages of India, where people don't have anything that we would call things. They have mud houses that sort of manage to hang together through the next rain. They have food that they can eat, but it's usually just a little bit of rice and dal, very simple. And yet you look into their eyes and you see that they are peaceful. And you know that somehow they have found something. You wonder how. They don't have cars. They don't have TV. In fact, to the extent that they are getting cars and getting TV, they're beginning to lose that peace in their eyes. And more as you go through India now, I went there first about 25 years ago, but now I see that there is that growing restlessness in their eyes that we have too. We've got to understand that we can't just have wisdom because we've read a lot of books. To be open to those who know what the realities are, not to think that we know it all already. This is the beginning of wisdom. The beginning of wisdom is the acceptance that we are not yet wise, the acceptance that we have something to learn, acceptance that wherever we may be on the path, there is still more ahead of us, the understanding that life is a process of constant growing. Discipleship doesn't mean to place your will under the will, the domineering will of another human being. Discipleship means rather the admission to oneself that I don't yet know all the answers, and I want to be open to those answers where I find them. Discipleship is an attitude. It's not much more an attitude than a particular position or a particular role in life. Discipleship means to be always open to learning new things, to absorbing new truths, to listening. It's really a process of listening. That when you're aware of what life can give you, you want to open yourself to it and say, well, what have you got to teach me? It does mean, and in a way I was being a disciple when I was a young man and going around the world and meeting all these, well, I didn't go around the world, but I went around a great deal. I was always trying to hear what life had to say to me. And I think the main problem was that I finally began to realize that people were just about equally stupid everywhere. Or not stupid, that's the wrong word. They're highly intelligent, but they use their intelligence to protect their ignorance. That's what they are, is ignorant. They think that they know a great deal because they're so clever. Ramakrishna, the great Indian saint, had a very wise little simile that he gave. He said, look at the crow. It's so clever, it's so quick, it flies away at the least sign of danger, and yet the poor creature can't help eating filth. And he said, this is how the worldly mind is, that it develops so much cleverness in knowing how the stock market moves and knowing how to invest and knowing what the latest ploys are in succeeding in business and so on, and yet all it can ever think about is just filth. Filth means things. Things that have no life in them. Things that, I read a book recently about people who were busy getting a great deal of money and got a great deal of money at the expense of a great many other people. And when they finally had it, what did they have? Death. There was no life in it. There's no life in money. There's no life in just things. The life is something that you can give to this world by what you are. And that which you are is something that you develop from inside yourself. And so it is that discipleship means to listen. To listen to silence more than to noise. It doesn't mean to just hear what everybody has to say, but also to hear what they're not saying. Because very often their words become masks for their realities. Listen to who they are. Listen, as Emerson said, what you are speaks so loudly I cannot hear what you say. To listen to the silences between people. I often think that two people can't be really close to one another until they can be comfortable together in silence. Where they feel that there's a communion without having to speak. Where they feel that even at a distance they can know each other's thoughts to some extent. To be able to walk down the street and not feel that you've got to carry a Walkman with you and listen to this noise from a radio station, but to be able to hear the birds in the trees, the wind rustling pages on the street, cars passing. All of these things, some things seem ugly. I remember an interesting thing years ago, speaking of the wind rustling pages and papers on the street. That's not a pretty sight, and it's a typical sight of our cities. I remember taking a woman home, a very old lady, to 16th Avenue in San Francisco from an ashram where I was giving the service. And I saw these papers blowing in the streets, and I thought, my God, I'll never live in this street. It was so strange, because 1 year later, I was living right across the street from her on that street. And I found a marvelous apartment. The outside wasn't very pretty. The outside were just these blowing streets. But behind there was a beautiful, quiet garden. I couldn't even hear traffic. It was a very nice apartment. And yet the outside was nothing. And so often you find with people, too, that the outside doesn't seem to be anything. But you get to know them and you find that there's a treasure house there. Because behind that facade, behind the outward appearances of life, very often there is something, some wonderful mystery to be explained, some wonderful discovery to be made. Don't go just by appearances. To be able to listen, to have the attitude of a disciple, means to be able to try to probe beneath the surface and to understand what this person has to say, what this experience in life has to offer. Sometimes I'm thinking of Leonardo da Vinci. In his later years, he was doing drawings of grotesque people, ugly people, and somebody was complaining that this was ugly. He said, "No, it's beautiful." I found, as a photographer, which is one of the roles I play in this life, I like to go around taking pictures, and I found that very often what I prefer to take is old people. Why? Because they're more beautiful. What makes them more beautiful? Well, certainly they aren't more beautiful if they've lived badly, but as it said, the first 40 years of your life you have the face God gave you, and the next 40 years or so you have the face that you made. And you can see how people have lived as they grow older. You can see it. I remember my mother. She died this year at the age of nearly 87. And every year, every time I saw her, she was more beautiful. Certainly older, but there was a beauty that was coming out from inside because of the way she had lived. If you look for the inside, if you look for those hidden treasures in life, you will find that very often they'll be buried in somebody's backyard. They'll be buried in the least expected places. But unfortunately, in this country, we are almost addicted to glamour. We're addicted to the outward appearances. To be able to be a disciple means to look under those appearances and try to feel, above all, God everywhere. Wherever we go, to try to see, what is God trying to tell me? I've had a wonderful experience sometimes just walking down the street, not looking, not having any eye contact with people. Make it more like a meditation. Not hiking, but just sort of strolling very slowly so that I can feel the energy and concentrate on the energy moving my limbs. And then listening to the sounds around me, and the sounds may be nothing but a car, or a dog barking, or a radio going on, or the noise of a car honking, or it can be also natural sounds like the wind in the trees or the birds. But try in each case to, first of all, share this with the inner communion that I've felt from God. I do this after meditation so that I feel that I'm sharing this with God too. And then I try to feel that God is saying this, saying something to me through these various noises, these various sounds. And I find that bit by bit it all becomes like a wonderful symphony. Individually, just as individually, the sounds in a symphony orchestra may not be all that beautiful. You listen even to the cello, which is a lovely sound, but there are points in the symphony where it's going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and you think, well, if you listen to this cello by itself, it wouldn't be doing anything. But added to the whole orchestra, it becomes very meaningful and beautiful. And so if you listen to things not only individually, but listen to them as a part of something much greater, you may often find, for example, that the painful experiences in life, to bring it onto a more personal level, that these, although not pleasing in themselves, have an overall meaning that's very, very important to you. I can look at my life and see the pains that I've suffered, and I can say that these are in some ways more important to me than the joys. They've made me think. They've made me grow up. They've taught me lessons that I wouldn't have learned if life had been only easy. I've often thought that people who are born, so to speak, with a silver spoon in their mouths and everything always goes right, that they are the unlucky ones. Those people who have had a hard life, so-called, are not to be pitied. I've had a hard life in some ways, but I think it's a great blessing that I've had it. Every time that I have understood, behind the lesson of pain, the deeper meanings, I have realized that this was a part of something much greater. Not only that, but even pain becomes beautiful then. Just as when you can go to see Hamlet, and at the end of Hamlet, everybody's dead practically on the stage. There's almost nobody left. And yet you go away and you think, oh, wasn't that beautiful? You wouldn't be able to say that if it happened to you, probably. Why not? Because you're too close to it. Because you identify yourself too much with it. But if you could step back from it and see it in proportion to the larger picture, you might indeed be able to say how wonderful. I remember one time Yogananda was, he lost the temple. It was a beautiful temple that he had in his colony in Encinitas, his hermitage there. And it went into the sea because of water that was undermining it. And somebody said later, what a pity that you lost that beautiful temple. Some people had compared it with the Taj Mahal, and many people. I think it was the setting that made it so particularly beautiful, perhaps. At any rate, somebody commiserated with him, and I remember his answer. He said, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because it made him go out and reach out to people more. It made him, he was getting so content and just teaching in that little beautiful, quiet, peaceful surrounding. And after that he had to get out and reach out to people again. This is what God wanted him to do. It was a great blessing. But he accepted it that way from the start. How many people would have wept and wept and wept, and finally, after many years, they look back and they say, gee, that wasn't all that bad. Look at all the blessings that have come from it. This is how we need to be. I remember one time up in the mountains, we were going skiing, and the car that I was driving, we were supposed to stop and put on chains, and I put my foot on the pedal, and I didn't realize that the two back tires were bald. And we just took off, as if we were on skis already. And I rammed into a Greyhound bus and totaled the car out. And so we took the bus to Truckee, where we rented a car and went skiing. But anyways, we got into the bus. The other passengers were saying, "Oh, what a pity you've totaled your car." And I was sort of surprised, because I hadn't really given it a value. I had merely accepted it was a fact. But I hadn't, in my mind, judged it to be a bad fact or a good one. It was just a fact. And now I was being told to judge it. And so I had to think about it. And I said, "Well, goodness, a week from now I'd feel fine. Why should I waste a whole week? I feel fine already." We need to be able to stand back from our experiences and see them in proportion to a larger picture. And when we do, we realize that after all, we may have lost a car, but we didn't lose our lives. That's a blessing. What does it matter anyway? In fact, when I stopped to think about it, that car hadn't cost me all that much, and now life goes on. We can always pick up the pieces. Why weep? When we weep, we're wishing that things were other than they are, and the sign of a mature person is to accept them as they are, because they aren't anything else. There's nothing you can do about it, or if there is anything you can do about it, the ability to change it will begin with the recognition of what it is now. Whereas if you constantly wish that it were something else, then you're not yet coming to grips with that reality, which then you may be able to change. In this case, for example, supposing I had been weeping so much over that car that it was totaled that the bus had left without us. We would have had a totally busted weekend. But as a result of just saying, "Well, all right, now what do we do?" we were able to get in the bus and go and have a good time. We have to be able to come to grips with reality, and discipleship is partly that too. Discipleship means, all right, what happens with people usually? When, I've noticed this very often, I'll get them to the point where they'll admit that, "Yes, I know, everybody's got faults, I have faults too." And you point out one. "Oh, not that fault." People will put up the biggest smoke screens to try to protect their failings. Well, if there's one thing that will always win in the end, it's truth. It may take a while, it may take even centuries, but sooner or later, truth alone endures. Because it's the only thing that really is, and all the fantasies we build up are simply not going to do it. And so, somebody comes and tells you something, and you may take it as an insult. Well, either he's right or he's wrong. If he's right, then maybe you can do something about it. Maybe you should be grateful to him for having pointed out something that needs changing. And if he's wrong, what does it matter that he thinks it? Praise doesn't make you any better. Blame doesn't make you any worse. You simply are what you are. But the worldly person is not about to admit anything. The worldly mind is always building barriers around itself to try to pretend that it is something that it may or may not be, but usually isn't. The worldly mind is hypnotized by opinions. If you look at TV, all you've got to do is turn on the TV set and watch just about any program, and you will find people building fantasies. Either it will be an advertisement in which they're absolutely delirious about Folgers coffee. Ask yourself, is it really something to get that delirious about? Or, finally, the ads are over and you see the movie. And what's happening with the movie? Well, somebody's insulting somebody, or shooting somebody, or hitting somebody, or angrily defending himself because somebody has said something that he didn't think was true. And they're all working on the basis of opinions, negative and positive, but not truth. Supposing somebody came to you and said that, "I think you're absolutely wrong in everything that you've ever done." What are you going to do? "Wait a minute!" Like this? Or are you going to say, "Well, that's very interesting. Would you be willing to help me? I'm eager to learn." How many people would give you the second reaction? There might be variations on the first, but there would be almost no opportunity to find any variations on the second, because very few people are willing to listen. Very few people are willing to consider the possibility that they might be wrong. And the usual argument is, if you point out something that they too know is wrong, they'll usually say, yes, but I'm not always that way. That wasn't the issue. It's to be assumed that you're not always that way. The fact that you can be ever that way is the point at issue. But oh, no, no, because they're not always that way, therefore, they're basically more good than bad, and therefore they're not bad at all, and therefore this didn't ever happen, and they'll sort of snow it under like that. Or what's another reaction? You point out something, hey, wait a minute, but you too, you know. Well, was that the issue? We can make that the issue if you like. But first of all, it was that you were exceedingly unkind to somebody that it might have been good to be more generous with? Is it really right to take your anger out on someone else, etc., whatever fault it might be? And so it doesn't change that for you to point out that I too have a fault if I've mentioned this to you, does it? Is the fact that both of us are wrong an excuse for either of us being wrong? People seem to think that that cancels it all out. The attitude of discipleship is to say, all right, let me see. Let me see. I was on a TV program the other, few weeks ago in Palm Springs, and they did three programs in one sitting, so that the man who was before me was on the program one day, and then my interview was the next day, and the following person was the program for the third day. And this one before me was a psychologist who was constantly saying, he was pointing out foibles in human nature, and then he was always coming in, well, and I count myself among those people. And it sounded very humble until you realize that he wasn't really admitting a thing. All he was just doing was saying, in principle, I count myself at fault, but I wouldn't have dared tell that man anything, because I think that if I did, he would get very defensive. And I don't like to attack people. If they want it, then I'm happy to suggest things. But I didn't feel that he was at all open, even though he constantly used this game. That's another game that people play. A game of being open in order to show, in order to give nothing away at all. Pretend that they are open in order to be able to protect themselves from anybody attacking them. Oh, I've already told you I was one of those, haven't I? Well, no, not like that, but... And so they are just building more walls around themselves. The attitude of discipleship is the attitude of wanting to know what really is. And that you can't create by your opinions. That you can't say, well, I think it's like this. Your thoughts may be right and your thoughts may be wrong. 90% of the time, the chances are they're wrong. And that's what we're here to learn, is how we can be right more and more. In a democracy, I'd say that probably the majority is always wrong. The minority has a possibility of being right. But we are going to be wrong again and again. What we need to do is not worry about it. Just say, okay, so I was wrong. You don't have to protect it. Be glad that you've been wrong and found yourself out, because truth should be your guide. Not opinion, not position, not... This is something very common with parents, isn't it? That they can't afford to be seen as fallible by their children, so they think. And so they play all these games to protect themselves and pretend that they were really right. But children are a lot smarter than they let on. They play their silly little games, and so you think that they're dumber than they really are. But underneath it, they know. And often they don't let on that they know. But I look back over my childhood, and I remember seeing things that I just didn't talk about. I'm sure you've done the same if you look back to your childhood. But they will respect honesty. They will respect fairness. You will be able to hold people's respect much more if you make truth rather than opinion, your guide. And this is all that discipleship is really about. Discipleship doesn't mean turning over the responsibility to somebody else so you don't have to do anything. It's the greatest responsibility of all to be able to face the possibility that you might need something, you might need to learn something in your life. To be able to say, all right, possibly I'm wrong, what can I learn more? To have this attitude is what we're really talking about. And this is something that this country needs. All countries need it. But it somehow seems to be right now, at least, and probably it's been so always, I don't know. It's something that we need to learn. To be open to truth wherever we can find it. The truth about ourselves. It's all very easy to be excited about the truth about some new galaxy. What about the truth of this galaxy of thoughts and emotions that you share? We live in too many delusions. To be able to hear wisdom, to be able to say, I am fallible, I want to know really what I'm fallible in. I want to know how I can learn. I want to listen. And another very interesting thing about it is, for example, when you listen to somebody, isn't he much more interested in talking then? If you come to somebody and sit down and say, tell me, isn't he much more interested in sharing with you than if you're sitting there tapping your feet and looking out the window and humming under your breath and waiting for him to shut up? When you listen to life, somehow life seems to arrange to give you lessons. There's a very interesting point there. In Autobiography of a Yogi, a great saint called Trailangaswami was fed a pot of clabbered milk, supposedly, but in fact it was lime, which would have killed him. And this man was scoffing. He wanted to show this wasn't a saint, and it was a very evil thing to do. But anyway, the saint took it as if it were clabbered milk, because he had such power that nothing could hurt his body. I know one saint who was able to drink 6 bottles of, I think it was bourbon. He probably didn't have that much blood in his system, and it didn't affect him at all. It just, he was able to drink it, continue talking. It didn't have any influence on his mind. Well, this Trailangaswami, the same way. But the moment he finished it, that man who had fed him that pot of clabbered milk fell screaming to the ground, holding his pain in agony. He said, Swami, help me, help me. I'm sorry I did this. And then the saint said, now that you've learned the divine meaning of boomerang, never do such a thing again. But what happens? First of all, there's a law, which is a boomerang kind of law, that whatever you put out, good or bad, comes back to you. And secondly, what is interesting, and this is the comment that Yogananda made in that passage. He said, saints have the power to allow the law to work instantaneously because they have banished the thwarting cross currents of ego. There isn't any ego to receive it, and so it goes back immediately. Now, in this world, we don't learn our lessons that quickly. Or we could say that because we're making so much noise that you say something, and people answer what you've said, and by the time they've answered it, your interest is somewhere else, and so you're not ready to hear it. And so whatever that lesson was passes you by and has to come around some other time when you're ready to hear it. The thwarting cross currents of ego are that we put out a kind of energy that we're no longer able to receive the results of, because our energy is going off in so many different directions at once. Sooner or later it'll come back to us anyway, but when it does come back, usually we've forgotten why it's coming, and so we think how unjust life is. But if you could really listen, and this is the point I'm trying to make, that when you listen, then life itself speaks to you. That the lessons that you're listening for are in fact given to you. Because when you listen, then the other person, in this case the universe, God, your higher self, is ready to teach, to inspire, to answer. And so that attitude of discipleship, actually opens up the doors so that we receive, as it were, through countless channels, divine blessings, divine power, divine guidance. And it's very interesting to observe how different cultures have been able to animate different aspects of nature just because they attuned themselves to those aspects. I remember going up to Vancouver, BC a few years ago to a conference, and it was the rainy season up there in December. And there was a man there who was an American Indian chief, Rolling Thunder. And he said that for this week there won't be any rain. And darn if he wasn't right. Just exactly when the conference ended, it began raining again. That power over the weather, that power over rain, this ability to receive messages. I know that there was another American Indian. She was part Indian, part white. And she told me that whenever a bird flew, she said, I get messages from the birds. And whenever a bird will fly against my window pane, I know that I'll receive word within a few days that somebody dear to me has died. Well, if that's true, according to our own Western modern scientific way of looking at it, then we would have to do it statistically. How many times do birds fly against windows, and do we get messages in a few days that somebody has died? If so, then there must be some sort of general connection. But you'll find that on the spiritual path, it doesn't work quite like that. It'll work for one person and not for anybody else. Because they have opened up that channel, because they have been willing to listen in a certain way. And so the universe will talk to them in these ways. It's very intriguing. There was another American Indian. They've been very in tune with natural phenomena, and that's why it seems to work so often with them. But I was sitting in a group in Arizona, in Sedona, and there was this Aztec woman Apache woman who came in, large, fat woman, squatted in the corner, and she kept lighting a match, and I didn't know what she was doing. But finally she said, well, I'll tell you one thing, a lot of willpower, too damn much willpower. What she'd been trying to do was test my willpower. She was able, by her willpower, to make the flame go toward the person that she was testing. And somehow this flame kept going toward her. I wasn't trying to do anything. But somehow she was in tune with flame and was able to make that show her something. Well, this sounds superstition, crazy, nonsense, stupid. Because you don't listen, you're not told anything. But if you listened, you might find that God would speak to you in particular ways because you've opened up a particular channel that you're able to listen through. And you'd find perhaps that nature has many things to teach you according to the particular way that you open yourself, like George Washington Carver with the humble peanut. God told him that he would give him hundreds of uses for the humble peanut. And think of all the wonderful things he discovered in that one little thing. If you attuned yourself to anything, you would find that God, not only that there are things there to be heard, but this is the wonderful thing because we're living in a conscious universe. We're living in a world that is not dead the way it seems to be, made of solid matter, but a world in which every atom is vibrant and alive, that everything is made of energy, that energy is only a manifestation of divine consciousness. Many so-called materialistic scientists have begun to say that the universe looks as if it were maybe just a dream in the mind of God. It looks very suspicious, very other than it appears to our gross senses. This whole universe is alive. And if you will respond to it as a living thing, it will treat you in one way. But if you respond to it as a dead thing, it will treat you in another way. And this is a very curious thing that I've observed in studying many civilizations, that the civilizations are able to somehow make their particular view of things work. In Bali, they practice magic. And they can make that magic work with the Balinese, but they can't make it work with us because we're not in tune with that. And yet, amazing things they seem to be able to do for those who are in that particular frame. It's really curious to see how people who view the world in one way, the world reacts in the way that they themselves expect. It's a very sort of mystical thought, isn't it? It seems almost superstitious until you try it. And then you begin to find that when you have that attitude of discipleship, when you have that attitude of openness, then somehow you find a great deal there to hear, a great deal to learn from, but it's even more than that. It's as if there was some conscious force responding to you. It's like I took some photographs in Hawaii, and as I say, I enjoy photography, and I was very pleased with what somebody said after a slideshow one time. She said that it looked as if the flowers were responding to your love for them. Why not? It's a nice thought. It's very interesting, too, to see how 10 photographers, presumably with the same basic lens openings and so on, taking a picture of the same thing, and somehow it will look different. It's as if they were putting out an energy that caused nature to respond in a certain way. I don't know, maybe I'm just going too far out. But you can take it as far as you want to, because up to a certain point, you must understand. You must be able to relate to it. And it's just that maybe you haven't experienced enough of this to be able to go all the way out on a limb with me in this weird thought. But even if the world doesn't consciously answer you, as I claim that it does, certainly you'll be able to find more if you're looking. Certainly you'll be able to hear more if you're listening. And the attitude of discipleship is that which says, I want to get myself out of the way. I want to know what is. I don't want to know what I think. I want to know what is. I want to make truth my guide and not opinion, not desire, not ambition, not ego. And when we have that attitude of discipleship, then the spiritual path opens up to us. Then God is able to give to us those things which we need. We don't have to run around looking for it. It will be given to us right here. God will send you teachings. God will send you a teacher. God will send you messages in so many different ways.